You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
I am Jamie Jennings in Norman, Oklahoma, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for Friday, May 15th, episode 3951. This episode is brought to you by Kentucky Performance Products. Good morning, horse people. Well, as you know, we are off for a few weeks, but we are thrilled to bring you some brand new one-on-one episodes. In full transparency, we did record this before the Kentucky Derby this year, so you may hear a little references here and there, but I just wanted to leave everything in to make it, you know, complete. So here you go. I've got Steve Haskin.
He was her first love, the one that started it all. He taught her how to master the posting trot and navigate her first hunter course. They spent hours together exploring the trails and hanging out in the barn. His name was doodled on every page in her school notebook. His coat gleamed in the sun as he met her at the gate each day, snuffling for a treat. From the first time she saw him poking his head out of the stall to the last time she patted him goodbye, he was, and always will be, her everything. This love story is brought to you by Nalox Advanced, providing complete support for a healthy digestive tract, which reduces the risk of colic and digestive upset. The horse that matters to you matters to Kentucky Performance Products. Call 859-873-2974 or visit kppusa.com to order today.
My guest today is Steve Haskin. He is one of the most respected and recognizable riders in American thoroughbred racing. Steve was actually inducted into the Horse Racing Hall of Fame in 2016. He's known for his thorough knowledge of the sport and especially for his coverage of the Triple Crown. He's the author of many books, has written for the Daily Racing Form, The Blood Horse, too many to name. And I'm a huge fan. And Steve is kind of a personal hero of mine, whether he knows that or likes it or not. And I'm honored to be sitting with him today. Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for being a part of this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Did you make all that up?
I just Googled you. Yeah. Well, I booked this interview with you a couple weeks ago. And when we were trying to nail down dates, you told me you had to check with the boss to see if you're available. I'm going to wager a guess. I know who your boss is, and her name is Joan.
You got it. How did you guess that? I can't imagine how you guessed that.
You said it so casually. I got to check with the boss. And I'm like, I know who he's talking about. So Joan has been a big part of your writing. I guess, you know, how has your family managed and handled your constant travel for where you've been? We'll get into it, but you've been writing since the 60s and traveling around. How has your family managed that?
They're just in awe of me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure she is. No, I read a little bit.
No, they've been great. I mean, you know, Joan has always been, you know, an inspiration. And, you know, when to share it with my daughter, Mandy, for all these years, and she was a major part of it. You know, when she was born, I became obsessed with getting photographs of her with every great horse imaginable.
Nice.
So she put up with it, you know, and she would make a face whenever I'd say, Mandy, go stand next to that horse. And then she would smile, give me a beautiful smile. But she now has a whole album full of pictures of her with Secretariat and Dr. Fager and Forgo and Seattle Slough and Affirmed and Spectacular Bid and Cigar. And I can go down the whole list of great horses that she's had her photograph taken with. And she wrote a beautiful piece, actually, several years ago, looking back in retrospect of what those photos really did for her and looking at them. And, you know, Joan has always been a major part of it. And always reads my stuff. Sometimes it gets a little tedious, especially during the Derby rankings. But she's always glued to the comments to make sure somebody doesn't say anything nasty or anything.
Well, you know, you mentioned her. You wrote this in a, what you guys don't know maybe is that Steve wrote the back page of the Blood Horse. Like, if you think about, if you know about Sports Illustrated, the back page was always written by this guy named Rick Riley. And you're the equestrian equivalent of Rick Riley in my head, because both of those I've read since I was younger. And you wrote this, you said, when you were to meet your future wife, quote, to demonstrate how far apart our worlds had been in our early 20s, I was at Saratoga to see Arts and Letters win the Travers in 69. The same day, Joan was 65 miles down the New York Thruway at Woodstock. And not only was she surely beautiful, but cool as well.
Yes, definitely. Just the thought that she was at Woodstock, you know, I find very exciting.
Sure.
You know, she was here. I would wish I was, but at the time, I didn't know any better. So being at Saratoga to watch Arts and Letters, I was very happy being there. But I never in a million years would have dreamed that our worlds would collide.
Well,
I should say come together. They didn't exactly collide, but several years ago, I wrote a column for the Blood Horse, you know, titled, you know, a love letter to Joan, and I talked about our whole life together, how we met and how fate brought us together and how it really changed my entire life. Cause I wouldn't even be close to where I am now without her.
I read that article, and one of the sayings you say, a couple things that you connect horses so eloquently with humankind, is that you said, I quote, wore a tie and a three-piece suit, even though the temperature was somewhere in the vicinity of 95 degrees. It didn't matter. I needed every advantage I could get to assure she didn't, at the very least, set a track record for eating lunch.
Boy, you've got me down right to every single word and comma.
I mean, and then my other favorite in that was, I was in my mind the equivalent of a $5,000 claiming facing a grade one champion. And here you are 46 years later.
Yes, I've graduated to a $6,000 claimer.
You can only go up from five, right? Oh, well, it's so beautiful to hear you talk about your family. And you know, researching this, doing this with you is so easy and also so difficult, because there's so much to go through and so much of your life. You were born, I'll give everybody a little background, born in 1947 in New York, and you didn't start out in racing. You initially worked on Wall Street. Tell us about that.
Well, yes, I was born in Brooklyn, on the streets of Brooklyn, just like, you know, any other Brooklyn street kid, and really had no skill. I was not very good in school, I hate to say, and I just had no idea what I wanted to be. And I went through a multitude of tedious jobs just doing, I was working in a printing company where, you know, my biggest interaction every morning was with the mice and the cockroaches. So it wasn't the most glamorous of jobs. And then got a job just being a quote boy. I was always some kind of boy. And they gave me a couple of little stocks to trade, and I wasn't very aggressive, and I really wasn't that good at it. And basically I had nowhere to go, and I was out of work for 9 months, and I had discovered horse racing in the 60s. And it reached a point where my mother wasn't even talking to me because I would go out every day and, you know, pretend I was looking for a job. But I would go to Battery Park, you know, to tip of Manhattan, and feed the pigeons and read horse racing books, and then go back and tell my parents, no, I tried, nothing today. But I never tried. The closest I came to trying was every day before going back home. I would go up to the offices of Dominic and Dominic to use their bathroom. That was the extent of my looking for a job on Wall Street. And then, you know, one day my father came in and said, so what do you want to do? I said, I have no idea. I don't know how to do anything. He says, well, what do you love? What do you love to do most of all? And I said, well, you know, my obsession, I love horse racing. So he said, well, why don't you get a job in horse racing? I said, horse racing, you know, it's like telling a kid who, you know, loves baseball, you know, why don't you get a job in baseball? I said, well, I can't be a baseball player. So how can I get a job in baseball? You know, you never think of being, well, there are other jobs in these sports other than participating in them. But I was not a writer. I mean, I didn't have any writing skills. I said, okay, I'll try to get a job in horse racing. And I wrote a few letters to different organizations, the New York Racing Association, the Jockey Club. I got a call one day from the secretary of the editor of the Morning Telegraph and said, can you come in for an interview tomorrow? I go, wow, the Morning Telegraph. I bought it every day. That was my Bible. Every time I went into the city, I would buy the Morning Telegraph and read it front to back. So I said, I don't know. I have nothing to offer. I mean, all I could do. So like an idiot, you know, I memorized the winner of every Kentucky Derby from like 1902 on, as if that was going to do me any good. But it was very exciting. And so I went down there, and it was the third day of the World Series where the New York Mets were playing in the World Series.
Wow.
And so I went in. I went to the interview. I sat down. I was all excited. I said, I can't believe I'm at the Morning Telegraph. You know, this is where I'd want to be more than any place. Mm-hmm. And the first question he asked me was, so do you know how to type? And I said, no. He said, well, sorry, we can't use you.
Oh, no.
He said, why don't you try learn how to type and then come back. I said, no, I can't learn how to type. I don't have the fingers for it, and I don't have the mind for it. There's no way in the world I could ever learn how to type. So I said, uh-oh, that's it. My life is virtually over. Now I got to go back and tell my parents the news that I'm still a bum. And while I was there, and I don't know what possessed me, but the person who got me interested in horse racing, his favorite horse was a horse named Graustark, who was standing at Darby Dan. He was now at stud, but he became my favorite horse. And so while I was there, I asked the editor, I said, listen, while I'm here, would it be possible to get the lifetime past performances of Graustark? He said, all right. So he called up the librarian and he came in. He says, can you help this fellow out? So I asked him for it, and we went back, and he had somebody, his cameraman, they were putting everything on microfiche at the time. So he asked his cameraman to take one of the big bound volumes where he found it and make a Xerox copy. And while he was making a Xerox copy, he told me, he said, you know, I'm going to need an assistant in here. Why don't you maybe get a job as a copy boy?
There you are, boy again.
Boy again. He said, get a job as a copy boy and learn how to type while you have the job. And once you do, you know, you can come in here as my assistant, which was the job I had been called in for the first place. So finally, I went into him one day and I said, I think I'm ready. And I did that. And he says, okay, you're ready. So he went into the editor and he said, I think he's ready to come in the library. So I came in the library as his assistant. And then the following year, an opening came available in the advertising department and he took it. So by him taking that, they made me the librarian. By making me the librarian, the following year, the Morning Telegraph went out of business.
Oh, my gosh.
And then I started, you know, I started to, like, freelance a little bit of writing. I figured, you know, I wanted to be creative. So I freelanced for a couple of publications here and there. And eventually, I was in the library for 20 years. And the editor would not let me write for the Racing Form. Huh. He wanted to keep me in the library. But I started writing, you know, for the Thoroughbred Record. I was writing. Then I got a really nice freelance job with the New Thoroughbred Times, doing feature stories and covering New Jersey racing. Going more and more. Next thing I knew, I was the lead writer and became the national correspondent. And they sent me to cover the inaugural running of the Dubai World Cup, going to Dubai and covered the Arc de Triomphe in Paris and covered all the Triple Crown races, all the major races, took over the Derby doings from the legendary Joe Hirsch. And it just escalated from there.
I mean,
and then the Racing Form sold, you know, they were taken over. They sold out to the people who had the Racing Times. They bought it and they brought in all their old writers. So I was like relegated down to like bloodlines columnist. But as soon as I was in the right place at the right time again. And the editor of the Blood Horse at the time, who was the managing editor of the Racing Times when I was there, who who got that job because I turned it down because my daughter was just born and my wife's parents had moved to Connecticut, to New Jersey. So I couldn't take that job. So he hired him. He went, became the editor of the Blood Horse, the executive editor. And then he then offered me a job at the Blood Horse, being the senior correspondent and writing books and editing the New York, the Kentucky Derby and the Breeders' Cup souvenir magazines. And it just, like I said, it just kept escalating. I was just so fortunate, and I was just in the right place at the right time.
I mean, but to be fair, you did right place at right time, 20 years of, you know, getting your hands dirty, doing all of that, being somebody's boy. And now you're a man. Congratulations.
Yeah, I mean, I always, and the funny thing is that I look back at, you know, my father telling me, you know, to get a job in horse racing. And I read his letter, and everybody who reads that letter swears it was written by me.
Wow.
So that made me believe, and I still believe to this day, that I've been so lucky, so fortunate, and being in the right place at the right time. If I didn't ask for this, if I didn't ask for Graustock Spare for Past Performances, if the librarian didn't take the advertising job, if for this and if and that, everything was if. And I was convinced that, you know, my father was just guiding me through all that. And unfortunately, after I got the job at the Morning Telegraph, when I was in the library, and he was always very proud of everything I did, even though I did nothing. I had taken some photographs that weren't very good, and he would bring it to work. And he was like so proud that I had photographs, and that I had a job. And unfortunately, after a year of working at the Telegraph, my father passed away, you know, at the age of 56, and it was really tough.
Wow.
But I still feel that, you know, he's been guiding me ever since. That's the only way I can explain it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we'll get into some. I mean, you have been a part of horse racing history here. I mean, just incredible. Mucho Macho Man is one of the horses that we here on the podcast have followed. I mean, from prep races to the Derby. We got to know his owners, Dean and Patty Reeves. They became friends of the show. We've talked to Kathy. We followed his entire career, even, you know, all the way up to when he won the Breeders' Cup, which is incredible. Glenn and I, my co-host, traveled to Edina Springs to meet Mucho Macho Man while he was at stud there. And I read something that you wrote, and it said, of all the races I covered, none affected me more emotionally than the remarkable parallel tales of Mucho Macho Man. This is the kind of story of which a writer dreams. You talked in that about it should be a book or a movie. When's the movie coming out, Steve? I need some movies.
I have no control over the movie, but it's funny you should ask, because about 3 days ago, I was, you know, Dean Reeves had a horse running this weekend in the Bluegrass Stakes. And, you know, I texted him and, you know, wished him good luck in the race. And the last thing he said, he says, so when are you writing the book on Mucho Macho Man?
Ah, see, it's a sign. You got books about so many others. It's his turn. You also mentioned that Smarty Jones' story would make a great book. And yes. I completely believe that.
Right. Well, you know, I feel good because I have to take credit, because I fought for several years to get him into the Hall of Fame, and we did last year. He was the only entity, horse or person, to get in the Hall of Fame. There were 14 names on the ballot, and he kept getting rejected every year. He was never put on the ballot, and I had to fight for him every single year. And finally, I was able to convince them to at least get him on the ballot. Mm-hmm. And he got on the ballot for the first time last year and was the only one to get into the Hall of Fame.
Wow.
So, you know, his owner, Pat Chapman, you know, thanked me at the induction ceremony. You know, she got up and, you know, thanked me for everything. And that was kind of nice. So it was nice getting him in the Hall of Fame. So
you've written about so many horses, and that is incredible, because I just have a soft place for Smarty, but I also so many other horses. So of all the horses you've written about, which one really affects you, like, most personally?
Well, first of all, you know, just getting back to Mucho Macho Man, the funny thing is that the story that I wrote when he won the Breeders' Cup Classic. And it wasn't me. My editor submitted that story for the Bill Leggett Award, and it won, you know, for Best Breeders' Cup Story. Oh. It was just such an amazing story, and you can really make a great movie out of it. I've also been working with someone who has been working, actually. He's a producer for years who's been trying to get a movie made about Canyonero II.
Oh, yeah.
Who won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness in 1971, who was an absolute phenomenon. That is the most incredible story. That's a story that you cannot make up. And I wrote extensively about Canyonero, and he actually did a documentary, and he's still trying. He's still trying and getting very close to getting some kind of a movie made about the horse. He even had me in the movie, and he was going to get my son-in-law, who was an actor, to play me in the movie. Oh, he had everything on set, but he couldn't get the funding for it. But he's been trying for 15 years.
Well, that
hopefully one day. But that's an incredible story. The most personal story, in a way. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'll have to look that one up because that's before my horse racing time. But I've got it written down here, so I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you go into Blood Horse Archives, there was a two-part story I wrote on Canyonero that tells the whole story about him. It really is, you can't make it up.
Wow.
But I'll tell you a funny story about this year's Kentucky Derby. And it has nothing to do with winning or losing or anything. But several years ago, an owner who I know very well, we were at Philadelphia Park together. He had a horse running in the Pennsylvania Derby. His name was Paul Redham. And he wanted to name a horse for me. And he had actually done that. And he named the horse Haskin, which is kind of a crummy name.
it's your last name.
I know. But it doesn't sound like a terrible name. I'm thank goodness the horse, I think, ran a couple of times that I didn't even know about and got hurt. And so I said, yeah, I mean, I would have cringed every time I heard the name. So he was at Philadelphia Park and he wanted to name another horse for me. I said, look, I said, don't name any horse for me. I said, if you want to name a horse for me, name it after my daughter. My daughter's name is Mandy. And she was and still is a beautiful, elegant, graceful ballet dancer. Not just being my daughter, but she was just would float over the stage. She was so graceful. And she always played Clara every year and then played Sugar Plum in Nutcracker. So I said, how about if you want to name a horse for me, how about naming it Mandy's Grace?
Oh.
So he said, oh, okay. So he did. So he named this filly Mandy's Grace. And I said, oh, okay, well, that's kind of cool, but nothing's going to come of it. Well, as it turned out, Mandy's Grace broke her maiden, won her first race the day that Mandy gave birth to her first child.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, Theo. And 8 years later, Mandy's Grace's son is in the Kentucky Derby this year.
No way.
His name is Pavlovian, and he won the $500,000 Illinois Derby. And just got beat ahead by the big favorite in the $1 million Louisiana Derby. So he is now in the Kentucky Derby. So if you see the name Pavlovian and see his dam, Mandy's Grace. So his dam is named after my daughter. So it's hard to remain objective with a name like that. But I do. I mean, you know, I haven't ranked him very high. He's still a long shot. You know, they have a Kentucky Derby future wager every month, where you can bet, you know, ahead of time. And in the last one that just closed was just a few days ago. But the one before that, you could have gotten Pavlovian at 210-1.
Oh, my God. Please tell me you put money on that.
I did not.
Oh, you're so objective. Stop it.
I did. I don't bet it. And I didn't even think about it. I wasn't even paying attention. And plus, I know he's going to be a long shot. He really has no shot to win. But now people are picking him.
Sure. And they actually
like him now. People are saying, oh, he's the only speed in the Derby this year. And I said, look, I don't want to get my hopes up. If he makes it to the Derby, I will be thrilled. It's a great story. It was a great story, and he won a $500,000 Sunland Derby by like a fraction of a, just a nut by a nose. And he's a game horse. He ran a tremendous race in both that race and the Louisiana Derby. He's just a gutsy horse and won't quit.
Well, so, you know, it does not matter if they're you know, the favorite or the longest odds, because anybody can pull it out. And if he's speedy, he's going to get out in front and hold it. I mean, Pavlovian, I'm putting money down.
Yeah, my wife's already putting $10 down. So
see, she's smart. So that one definitely affects you personally. Yeah. So do you ever get like a gut feeling about a horse, and how often is that gut feeling right?
But yeah, you always get gut feelings about everything, but there's no way to really explain a gut feeling. It's just a feeling you have that that horse is going to run well. And most of the time, the gut feelings don't come to pass. They don't run well. They remain in your gut. That's where they are. You know? And then they bore a hole in your gut afterwards.
Yeah. Or your wallet, which is what happens to me.
Yeah, exactly. But so, I always look for connections to the horses that I grew up with, basically. And when I say grew up, I mean in my racing life, my old favorite horses, the early days of Damascus and Dr. Fager and Arts and Letters. These were all my favorite horses that were my sports heroes. They replaced all my baseball heroes, my football heroes.
I have the same thing. Obviously, you can see all I have is my favorite. Yeah,
I see your secretariat photo right behind you.
Yes. And all the halters that I can get and everything. So racing is a huge special thing to me. But you, as a writer, do you also bet on them, or do you try to keep it just strictly?
I do. I don't bet a lot. I bet very small amounts. You know, once in a while, if I really like a horse, you know, I might bet $20 or $40 on it. But only in a Triple Crown race or a Breeders' Cup Classic or a Breeders' Cup race. I won't just bet for the sake of betting. I don't really pay that much attention to betting. But I like to bet the Kentucky Derby. And there were a few derbies and Triple Crown races that, you know, I've won good money on, or Breeders' Cups. But, you know, over the course of the years, just like everybody else, you lose money.
But I mean, for real, you've been involved in racehorses for, I don't know, 50, 60 years. So you can only say you've won a couple. I don't believe that.
Well, I mean, I've won more than a couple, but a couple of memorable ones, you know, where I'd say I've won. The most exciting thing was having the first time I ever had to fill out, you know, the IRS form, because.
Yeah. So
I think I collected like $1,300 on that. But, you know, nothing, I mean, nothing, you hear guys making $20,000, $30,000, you know, but.
Yeah, they're also losing $90,000 to $100,000 that same day. So, yeah, you've never been the guy with security escorting you out to your car with suitcases? Never been you?
No, I've always dreamed of that happening, but I never did. The one horse that really got me upset, and believe it, it's a horse that I did bet on, but.
Oh, if you say this name, I'm gonna, because there's one horse that broke my heart and screwed me over, and I lost so much money on. And I'm wondering if it's the same one you're gonna say.
I guarantee you, this is not the same horse.
Okay,
but it's a horse who ran in the Breeders' Cup Classic. Okay.
Okay.
And it's a horse that I had discovered through some connections I had in France, that this horse had been working really well on the dirt. And I found out all the problems that he had, because he was an up and down type of horse, and he had back problems, and he couldn't handle the undulating grass courses in France. But he loved the flat course on the dirt. And I wrote about it in the racing form, and you know, people saw it. So it came time to make selections. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to pick this horse in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I'm just going to pick him. And then I started realizing there was another horse I kind of liked. I said, well, I asked the editor. I said, look, are you having 1, 2, 3 and a long shot? He said, yeah, as usual. I said, okay, I'll put the other horse first, and I'll put this horse as my long shot pick. Well, the next day, the Telegraph came out, and there was no long shot picks. They decided to drop it. So I had no connection of that horse as far as the picks go. So I got into the track in the morning, and I said, well, you know, let me just bet, you know, $4 on him right now, and then I'll, you know, bet more later. I'll see what kind of odds he's going off at. It was in the morning, so I bet like $4 on him, and I was covering two other races that day. So I was all busy riding, and I completely forgot to bet. And I said, that's okay. I mean, he's not going to win anyway. Well, the horse wound up winning the Breeders' Cup Classic and paying $238. His name was Arkang, and he had come from France, and nobody paid any attention to him. And he won easily. And I collected a measly, you know, $400 or $500 when I – everybody I gave it to telling me how they won $10,000. Oh, I won $20,000 on the horse. You gave them to me. I won $10,000. How much did you win? $400, you know.
And you know, like, you didn't even get credit for that pick.
And I got no credit for picking that horse. I have no credit for picking that horse at all. You know, as Marlon Brando's, you know, said in On the Waterfront, I could have been somebody. I could have been a hero. I could have been a champion. I got nothing out of that. I was more upset about that. I said, look, I could have made thousands on it, which would have been great, but it would have come and gone. But they could never have taken my name away from picking that horse.
And
I didn't have it. And so I had no connection to picking that horse. And I was like depressed for a week. I even wrote a column about it. The whole column was about how depressed I was.
That's what's great about that column. Yeah. You guys, if you want to hear more of Steve, just Google the archives of the Blood Horse, because the way he's talking to us right now is exactly the way you wrote and still do write. So at this point, by the way,
excuse me one second. I just want to say that was in 1993, by the way. I have not watched that race once since.
Oh, no way.
I can't watch it. It still gets me upset having to watch that race.
You hold a grudge. I don't blame you.
Yeah, well, I'm holding a grudge against myself. I have nothing against the horse.
The horse that broke my heart was Maximum Security, which I know you've talked about.
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That's a bad way to lose.
Yeah. I'm still mad. So what I want to do right now, because you have covered, I mean, you've been around all the horses. Like you said, your daughter got pictures with all the greats that there are. And so what I wanted to do was I'm going to just name a couple that are a little bit more at top of mind for, you know, people more recently than the 60s. So what I'm going to do is name a couple horses, and I want you to give me like 1, 2, 3, 4 sentences, get a little story about each one of them. Do you mind?
Nope, not at all.
Okay. Well, I mean, we have to start with, you mentioned him already. Let's start with Secretariat.
Well, you know, for the last 5 years, I've been writing for Secretariat.com. That's right. Been my website. And my favorite story, well, Secretariat, I don't have to tell anybody how great a horse he was. I followed him throughout his career. And I took a lot of photographs of him. And they all just lay dormant for over 40 years in a crummy old album or so. And when I worked for Secretariat.com, the fellow who runs the website, who founded it with Penny Jennery, I sent him those photographs, and he restored them, and he sells them now. But I found one photograph of Secretariat that I had taken, and it was just a little one. This is 3.5 by 5 of him coming by me before the Bayshore Stakes. And he came a little bit too close, and so my focus wasn't 100% there. It was good, but I got a really great shot of him. I just wasn't happy with how sharp it was. Anyway, when we were moving to Connecticut, I found that old photo, and I didn't know what to do with it, so I put it on Facebook. I took a picture of it and put it on Facebook, and I said, this is for the heck of it. And it got a lot of comments. It got hundreds and hundreds of comments, and people loved it. And I said, wow. So I mentioned it to Leonard, you know, from Secretariat.com, and I sent him. So he made up a 5x7 copy of it. And that's the last I heard. Next thing I know, a few years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago, we're at Saratoga and we're walking down on Broadway, and I'm passing by one of the stores there, gift shops. And I look in the front, there's a big display of T-shirts with that photo. Excuse me. Whoops. You know who that is, by the way? That's the head of that's the head of Spendthrift Farm.
Calling you right now?
Yeah, hold on.
Do you take it?
Ned?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I'm doing an interview right now on Zoom. Can I call you back? That's okay. Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Hi, Ned.
The funny thing is that that's Ned Toffee, and the first favorite for the Kentucky Derby this year is the horse that was named after him, but they made a mistake and he was named
Ted Noffee.
And he unfortunately got hurt. But we were just at Spendthrift Farm just a couple of weeks ago because I gave a lecture at the Keeneland Library.
Oh,
so
wow.
We took some friends with us, and you know, we made a nice vacation out of it. Anyway, I noticed this story was getting too long, but as it turns out, that photograph somehow wound up in the hands of a Saratoga artist who was our favorite artist, Celeste Suzanne, who's got a big stand at Saratoga, and she's a brilliant artist. And it was Secretary's 50th anniversary, and she had been looking for the perfect photograph of Secretariat that would show everything about the horse, and she couldn't find it. And she somehow saw that little 5x7 that Leonard had made up, and she said, "That's it. That's the photo I've been looking for. That's the photo I've been looking for ever since I started this." And she just thought it brought out every part of Secretariat that she was looking for. And so she asked if it was okay, if she could do the painting of it. And he said, yeah, I'm sure he wouldn't mind. He, not knowing that I knew Celeste, we had bought a painting from her like the year before. As it turns out, she made the t-shirts out of it, note cards. And then I go into the National Museum of Racing. There's a Secretariat exhibit going on. And right in the front is that painting framed in the museum.
Wow.
And I'm saying, what's going on here? This is like crazy. As it turns out, she wound up selling the painting for $15,000 from this little photograph that had been laying around for 40 years, this little 5x7 photograph. And
I mean, that begs
I'll send you, I can send it to you. If you send me your text, I can send it to you. And I have my photo on top of her painting.
We'll put that as the show notes. That's what we'll do. That'll be the head. I mean, because that begs the question, did you get a cut or did you at least get a free t-shirt out of it?
I don't get a cut of anything. All the pictures that I sell, I just let it go, you know, towards secretariat.com. And the people love the photographs because they're all different. They're not your typical shots, and they all have a story behind it. And one of them that everybody loves is a photograph I took of Secretariat at Claiborne Farm. And he looks like a little kid with a lollipop in his mouth. He picked up a big branch, a big long stick, and he put it in his mouth, and it was hanging right out of the front of his mouth like a lollipop. And he brought it over to me at the fence and dared me to pull it out of his mouth. So I took a picture of him with this stick coming out of his mouth. And after I took the picture, and I'm pulling, I could never get it out of his mouth. We're having a tug of war with Secretariat.
Wow.
I couldn't get it out of his mouth. And we wound up playing fetch with it. And it was like crazy. But anyway, that photo sold for like $300 or so. But, you know, Leonard's been selling that photo and other photos I took at the Preakness, but they're all personalized for different kinds of photos. So I've been obviously very, very close to Secretariat, especially since working for Secretariat.com.
Absolutely. And I know you can go on Secretariat.com and look at these pictures and also purchase these pictures. So everybody definitely check that out. Tell me a little bit about one of my favorite horses, Seattle Slough.
Well, I got lots of pictures of Seattle Slough as well, but Seattle Slough was just an amazing horse. And I was around him quite a bit. I'd go down to the barns and visit him. And I'll never forget talking to Billy Turner. It was early in the year. And Billy Turner had a concern because Seattle Slough had just won his first start of the year in an allowance race where he ran the 7 furlongs, breaking the track record in 120 and 4, which was unheard of. 120-3, actually. And I remember Billy Turner had no qualms at all about the Kentucky Derby. He knew this horse was going to win the Kentucky Derby. But I remember him saying, God, this horse is so fast. He says, how am I ever going to win the Belmont with him? That's all he kept thinking about. He kept
down the road.
And he went through the Derby. And I got to know Billy Turner quite well. Just the nicest guy. Had his problems, you know, with alcohol, which he admits. And then the day Seattle Slough won the Triple Crown, right after he won the race, a friend of mine drove me right to the airport because I was flying to Europe that year to go to the English Derby and the Irish Derby.
Wow.
But, yeah, cool. Slough was a rocket. And I saw him many times at Three Chimneys Farm and was with him with Mickey Taylor, his owner, and he would be talking to him. So he was a wonderful horse to be around. And one of my favorite stories I wrote was called The Life and Death of Seattle Slough. And it was how appropriate he was. It was for him to die the day he did. And I explained why it was an appropriate day to die. So,
wow.
Anyway,
I saw him.
My words there, thinking about
no. It. Yeah. Oh, that's sweet. I saw him at Three Chimneys when I went to school in Kentucky and got the opportunity to go visit him. And that was back when, I don't know if they still do it, but they would have somebody gallop all the stallions every morning. Yeah. And oh my God, I wanted that job so bad. I was like, who do I have to talk to? But turns out, yeah, they didn't need me.
Yeah. Oh, well, you can always dream.
I know, right?
By the way, some farms do that. If you ever get to Kentucky, some farms still gallop their stallions.
I go every single year. I'll be there in a couple of weeks. Another one that you've written about was one of the most incredible recoveries in a race, a Fleet Alex who stumbled out of the gate at the Preakness in 2005 and then went on to win the dang thing.
Yeah, well, he was one of the stories I told at that lecture, you know, because they wanted me to talk about my book, Tales from the Triple Crown, which I told all these behind the scenes stories. Feel good stories, human interest stories. And I told the story of him because, you know, unfortunately, you know, he died earlier in the year. And that was the most amazing thing. I cannot believe it. If you could have heard me when that happened, if you could have heard the four letter word that started with an S that came and went ahead, because I was watching the race on the screen in the infield, and had my video camera with me, so I was videotaping it in case I missed part of the race. I can go back and write about it. I was videotaping it, so you could see the race on the screen and hear me. And all of a sudden, you can hear me on the day going, "Oh, I didn't say shoot." You know, I could not believe that he stayed up, and I'll never forget the next morning. Went to the barn, and his jockey, Jeremy Roach, was sitting on the bench, and the Fleet Alex was out grazing. And he came over to him, and he just rested his head on Jeremy Roach's shoulder. Jeremy Roach took out a little mint and fed him while his head was on there. And I looked at it, and I said, boy, here's a horse and a jockey. Both of them pulled each other out of the abyss. Mm-hmm. And this is like the scene of gratitude, sometimes gratitude comes just in small little pictures like that of him sitting there just taking a mint out of the wrapper. I don't know why. As we speak, by the way, I'm doing it. I'm doing it with my hands, taking the mint out of the wrapper like people can see me.
I think all of us are, because we can all identify that moment of when a horse makes a connection with you. And I galloped and hot walked and did all the things. And sometimes the only way to keep the horses from killing you when you are a young, tiny 19-year-old girl is to just continue to unwrap mints while you're hot walking them. So please behave.
Right. You know how many times I've used that sound to get a horse to come to the front of the stall so my daughter could get a picture with him? Now it's my wife who's the guinea pig.
<You're right.
laughs> The thing with the Fleet Alex is that it's just a great story from the start, because the mayor couldn't give any colostrum and they had to find a nurse mare for, so it took several weeks. And in the meantime, the breeder's 8-year-old daughter fed him milk from a Coors Light bottle.
Wow.
And then of course there's a whole story between Alex's lemonade. There's so many parts to a Fleet Alex story that was so heartwarming.
It was. Okay, let's go cigar.
If I told you how many photographs my daughter has with cigars, she grew up with cigar. Oh God, I have so many cigar stories. Well, the thing is that the big story was going all the way to Dubai to see him run in the first ever Dubai World Cup. Nobody knew if that race was going to be a success or not. And the fact that he won it made it a success, but I had never been anywhere around there. So to be a part of that was so exciting, to be in Dubai and covering a race like that. One of my fond recollections was I was covering the Eclipse Award dinner in San Diego, and I had arranged the next day, Cigar was making his 4-year-old debut at Gulfstream Park in the Don Handicap. And I arranged to fly back on Alan Paulson's private jet with him and his wife and their little dog and Bill Mott and his wife, Jerry Bailey and his wife.
Wow.
And the only other person on the plane besides me was Joe Hirsch. And I wrote a whole story about being on the plane. And, my first thought was that I listed all the people on a plane. I said, if this plane ever goes down, my name's going to be like this little footnote at the end of the story. I mean,
never fly with people more famous than you, right?
But I mean, Madeline Paulson, and I look up and I'm dozing off and she's covering up with a blanket. She was a flight attendant and she had me go up front in the cockpit. And it was just so great. And the plane arrives at, 5 o'clock in the morning. I got to run to the hotel and wound up going to track and then seeing Cigar, win his first start of the year in the Don Handicap after flying back on the private jet, which was the fastest jet in the world at the time.
Wow. Incredible. Okay. Tell me, we got to go with some super fillies. Let's do Rachel Alexandra.
You should see the pictures I have of her that I just took with her. Rachel was just an amazing story. I mean, covering her races in the Preakness and then where she beat the Colts, and then in the Haskell beating the Colts, and then that amazing race in the Woodward where she became the first 3-year-old filly ever to win the Woodward Stakes, which is one of the most historic races. But she was as good a filly as I've ever seen. She just could do it all, and she did it so easily. And I was pretty close with her. Again, there's so many stories I could tell about her, but she just the fact that she was just such a wonderful filly to be around, and the way she just decimated her opponents and just beat the Colts the way she did. And I had a week after I went to Dubai with my wife and my daughter, we had been invited to go to the opening of the new Maidan and the first the 10th running of the Dubai World Cup. We had gone there, and a week afterwards, I had plane tickets and hotel reservations to go down to Oaklawn Park to cover the big match between Rachel Alexandra and Zenyatta. And I was doing a day-to-day diary about how that was leading up to the race. And then, unfortunately, Zenyatta got hurt and couldn't come, so I canceled my reservations, unfortunately, but that's as close as I've ever gotten to Oaklawn Park. But that could have been one of the great races of all time, Rachel against Zenyatta.
To be fair, I'm kind of glad it didn't happen because neither one of those mares deserve to have their heart broken,
Yeah. I wrote a column saying that it was meant to be, that they would not face each other because both of them had such a strong fan base. And you just didn't want to see either one of them get beat, really. I think, to me, this was the greatest rivalry of the mind.
Yes, exactly.
You know, so just envision what would have happened. You could envision any way you want, but just let that rivalry, let that big match race between them exist in your mind only. That's where it belongs.
It ends in a dead heat every time in my mind.
Exactly.
So then tell me about Zenyatta.
Zenyatta, one of my memorable moments was covering her Breeders' Cup Classic victory. And, you know, I'm coming down the elevator with Jerry and Ann Moss, the owners, and John Sheriffs and his wife, Dottie. And yeah, I come off and I'm about to go back and cover the race. And they invite me to come to dinner with them.
Wow.
And I said, well, I wasn't expecting that. So I wound up going over to John Sheriff's house, and he was showing me all his video stuff and how he had cameras in Zenyatta's stall. Went over his house for a while, and then we all went to this restaurant, and we're sitting, and we have Zenyatta's saddle cloth that she wore that day, and Ann and Jerry Moss and Dottie taking the saddle cloth and wrapping it around their head like a kerchief, and I'm taking pictures of it. And here I am sitting at the table with the owners of Zenyatta, the trainer of Zenyatta, Mike Smith and his girlfriend, David Ngordo, who's Dottie's son, who picked out Zenyatta. And I'm saying, what am I doing here?
I don't think you realize what a big deal you are. You're so humble, but these people were probably couldn't believe you were at their dinner.
Well, probably some people were, except for the ones who whoever, I can't even remember which one invited me, but they said, oh yeah, you gotta come. I said, okay, but that was pretty wild. But that, you know, we visited Zenyatta several times at Lane's End and went to Hollywood Park to see her. So, you know, a lot of great memories of Zenyatta as well. But that day was pretty special. And of course, the day she got beat in her last start was just so crushing. And it was the best race she ever ran. That was,
okay. We don't talk about that day.
A lot of people can't watch that race. That was the best race she ever ran by far on the dirt. She had so many excuses in that race as well. Mm-hmm. And how she did that, what she did to fly down a stretch like that against a good horse like Blame and just fall a head short. And she had her head in front and one step past the wire. And I was down on the track and with John, and he was like almost in a state of shock. And it was just so sad to see her career end that way, even though he was so proud of her. But probably the greatest day I ever spent at a racetrack was the following day when I had to write a story and I kept going back to the track, but they took Zenyatta out and brought her out on the grass behind the barn, right by the fence on Longfield Avenue, and had her out there all day. And wow, people would come up to the fence. People would come from the backstretch, would come to the barn, and they would like line up a long line of people to get their photo taken. Wow. With Zenyatta. And she was out there all day allowing people to pet her and kiss her and put their arms around her and take pictures with her all day. And then people would show up at the fence and the police would come and tell them to move their cars and they wouldn't do it. So the police finally just left and said, the heck with it. And they would bring Zenyatta to the fence and people would feed her apples under the fence. One woman brought a cake that had to climb and put over the fence. And then finally, at one point, I'm trying to write a story. I'm running back and forth, and you're going, and I said, I can't not be here for this.
Right.
And I went, and finally, Ann Moss said, let me take some pictures of you. I said, no, that's okay. She goes, no. So I gave her my camera, and she took like about 9 or 10 pictures of me with Zenyatta that are really great photos. Wow. Of me kissing her and hugging her. And but that was a day I'll never forget. All day she was out there. Nobody would have done that except John Sheriffs and the Mosses.
Yeah.
They were great, great, great for the game.
Amazing people. I'm so excited to get to see her. I'm going to go to Kentucky in a couple of weeks, and I've got a tour to go see her. And
great. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
I want to promote all of your stuff. You please go to secretariat.com and you can see all of Steve's writing there. Obviously, the Blood Horse has an archive. Just Google Steve Haskin and you will see it. Check his Facebook page out. There's a store on secretariat.com. You can get all of these awesome pictures that we've talked about. And I mean, what an absolute thrill to sit here and talk with you. And I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, I appreciate you having me. It's been a lot of fun. And if you do go on and look at the photos, I write a little story behind each photo that's on there. So there's always a story behind every photo that I take. But I had a great time and it was just great talking to you. And I really do appreciate you having me.
Well, thanks again for joining me. And if you're new here, be sure to hit subscribe as we have some other fun new one-on-ones for you coming up. Have a great weekend and spay, neuter, and geld.